This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
This is Queer Voices.
Good evening. This is Jack Falinski.
And Jennifer Renee.
Hey, J.D. Doyle.
And Glenn Holt.
Well, tonight's show, Jennifer, looks like you're coordinating most of it.
Well, it's sort of with a transgender theme tonight. Queer Music Heritage. J.D., you can tell us about it.
Yeah, the second hour is QMH, and my special tonight is the first of two parts on transgendered music and artists, and I've got some, I think, really interesting interviews. One with a showgirl from the 60s, a drag female impersonator showgirl from the 60s who transitioned in 65.
Wow.
So like 42 years ago.
Oh, my God.
And then she quit show business and then went on to the rest of her life. And I've talked with her. And then I've also talked with the leader of an all-tranny band from San Francisco, Lipstick Conspiracy. So you have different perspectives of coming out of the trans closet.
Oh, that sounds good. I'll be interested to hear those interviews. Also, we have with us tonight George and Chris, who are both female-to-male transgenders, a subject that a lot of people don't know a whole lot about, and hopefully we're going to learn some more about that tonight. Also, in the first hour, the second interview is with Chris Daly, and she is the director of the Transgender Law Center in San Francisco. And we're going to discuss the ascension to the position of police commissioner in San Francisco, the first transgender, a woman by the name of Teresa Sparks.
Great. All that's coming up, and you know, with Queer Music Heritage, we need to get right into the show.
Yes, we do.
Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Don Lupo.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending May 26, 2007. ILGA, the International Lesbian and Gay Association, announced this week that the United Nations Committee on Non-Governmental Organizations had denied NGO status to the Swedish LGBT Federation, RFSL, and deferred consideration of two other LGBT national federations, FELGT from Spain and ABGLT from Brazil. Only a handful of LGBT groups have successfully gained such status at the UN. In an effort to expand the number of queer voices there, ILGA has conducted a campaign since 2005 to have more LGBT groups apply for NGO status. Representatives of several countries dominated by conservative religious beliefs on the UN Selection Committee, however, have blocked most of them.
But Nepal's Blue Diamond Society announced this week that the Federation for Sexual and Gender Minorities, Nepal, has been registered at the District Administration Office in Kathmandu. Nine organizations working on HIV/AIDS, human rights, and constitutional and legal reforms for sexual minorities are the founding member organizations of the now government-recognized Federation. Blue Diamond leader Sunil Pant called the registration another step forward to promote human rights in the Himalayan nation.
Lithuania's first LGBT pride celebrations got off to a bumpy start in mid-May when bus drivers in the city of Kaunas refused to drive buses displaying ads from the Lithuanian Gay League. Three of the large ads running the length of the buses and also appearing on the back said, "A lesbian can work at school, a gay man can serve in the police force, and homosexual employees have a right to be open and safe." A spokesperson for the bus company said the drivers feared they would be mocked by friends and that the buses would be vandalized. After the company demanded guarantees that it would be reimbursed for smashed bus windows and the like, the agency that placed the ads had them removed. The ads were also set to run this week on buses in the capital city of Vilnius. They cost more than the equivalent of $6,500 to produce and place and were funded by the European Union and the Lithuanian government. Vilnius Mayor Jostas Imbrasas banned the ad's appearance there as well. "We tolerate people of any kind of sexual orientation," said Imbrasas. "Nevertheless, with priority for the traditional family and seeking to promote family values, we disapprove the public display of homosexualist ideas in the city of Vilnius." The display of a 30-meter rainbow flag in the city square was to be the centerpiece of Lithuania's first pride events in Vilnius. Other announced activities included seminars, panel discussions, cultural programs, a dance party, and distribution of LGBT-related information to the public.
Vilnius officials this week also voted to bar another bus promoting tolerance from entering the city. Sponsored by the European Union and carrying the slogan, For Diversity, Against Discrimination, it's an effort to educate people about the EU's human rights laws, among them, those guaranteeing the rights of the continent's LGBT communities. This is the fourth year the bus has toured EU capitals, with 19 cities scheduled in 2007, but Vilnius is the first to rebuff the campaign. The City Council's unanimous rejection cited information it claimed to have received that anti-queer protesters were planning to disrupt events related to the bus's arrival. The European Commission issued a statement saying that the decision by the city authorities shows how much still needs to be done to change behavior and attitudes towards discriminated groups and to promote awareness of diversity.
India's foreign ministry is resisting Canada's request that the same gender partners of two of its diplomats, one a lesbian and the other a gay man, be granted diplomatic spousal privileges. Legal same-gender marriages, such as those in Canada, are not recognized in India, and homosexual acts, or carnal intercourse against the order of nature, are punishable by up to 10 years in prison under India's Penal Code Section 377. Legal challenges to the statute, a remnant of British colonial rule, are stalled in the courts. Canadian officials have reportedly suggested that under Vienna conventions on diplomatic and consular relations, Canadian diplomats would not be subject to Section 377. But India's foreign ministry maintains that those conventions only provide immunity from criminal procedures and that laws of the country from which the diplomat is based are not relevant.
Kanako Atsuji, Japan's first openly lesbian or gay politician, this week announced her decision to run in July's national elections in what she called a challenge to government ignorance. The 32-year-old Atsuji is running for a seat in the upper house of parliament, representing the country's main opposition Democratic Party, and is the first openly queer candidate to be supported by a major political party in Japan. In 2003, Atsuji became the youngest candidate ever elected to the Osaka Prefectural Assembly and one of only seven women on the 110-seat body. She led a policy change to allow same-gender couples in Japan's second-largest city to rent public housing, and halfway through her four-year term, Atsuji went public with her autobiography, Coming Out, A Journey to Find Myself. She also marched with about 2,500 other people in Tokyo's Pride Parade in 2005 and has maintained the support of her local constituents. In a message on her website, Atsuji said Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has failed to address sexual diversity within Japan. I think there's a tendency to put forward one set of values and make it seem as though that is the only beautiful or right way, she wrote. But the reality is that Japanese society is not engaging with the wide range of people living in diverse ways in terms of nationality, race, sex, age, and disabilities.
In the latest developments surrounding a seemingly inevitable schism in the global Anglican Communion, openly gay New Hampshire Bishop V. Gene Robinson of the U.S. Wing's Episcopal Church has not been invited to a once-a-decade meeting of world Anglican leaders next year. A breakaway conservative U.S. bishop was also snubbed. Robinson, who lives with his male partner, called the decision an affront to the entire Episcopal Church. The other prelate, Bishop Martin Minns, leads a U.S. Episcopal parish network formed by outspokenly anti-queer Nigerian Archbishop Peter Akinola to counter the liberal-leaning American denomination on its home turf. Akinola said this week that not inviting Minns will be viewed as withholding an invitation to the entire House of Bishops of the Church of Nigeria. Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, the spiritual leader of the Anglican Communion, said he took the rare step of withholding the two invitations so that the meeting, called the Lambeth Conference, can focus on keeping Anglicans together. He said he didn't want to invite bishops whose appointment, actions, or manner of life have caused exceptionally serious division or scandal within the Communion. More than 850 other bishops have been invited to the conference, scheduled to begin in July 2008 at the University of Kent in England.
The U.S. Episcopal Church supports both the ordination of openly lesbi-gay bishops and the blessing of same-gender unions. Anglican leaders meeting earlier this year in Tanzania said that the Episcopalians risk expulsion from the international communion if they don't ban both by September 30th. Episcopal bishops are scheduled to meet on September 20th in New Orleans to confront that challenge. At the last Lambeth Conference in 1998, bishops overwhelmingly adopted a resolution declaring same-gender relationships incompatible with Scripture and opposing the legitimizing or blessing of same-sex unions and ordaining those involved in same-gender unions. Bishop Robinson said in a statement this week that it makes no sense to exclude gay and lesbian people from the conversation. It is time that the bishops of the Anglican Communion stop talking about gay and lesbian people and start talking with us.
In U.S. state news this week, the Nebraska Senate voted 24-15 to reject a bill that would have added sexual orientation to the state's anti-discrimination laws. Such measures have failed for the past 14 years in the state legislature. Nebraska law currently prohibits workplace discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, disability, or national origin. But two of Nebraska's neighbors have passed lesbi-gay civil rights protections in recent weeks. Iowa Governor Chet Culver signed his state's anti-bias bill into law at a ceremony this week, while Colorado Governor Bill Ritter is expected to sign a similar bill in his state. Governor Jim Douglas this week signed into law a measure banning discrimination in Vermont based on gender identity or expression. And Ohio Governor Ted Strickland issued an executive order last week protecting more than 60,000 state employees from discrimination based on their sexual orientation or gender identity.
And finally, Mary Cheney, the lesbian daughter of U.S. Vice President Dick Cheney, gave birth to an 8-pound, 6-ounce baby boy this week at Sibley Hospital in the nation's capital. Cheney and her partner of 16 years, Heather Poe, named their son Samuel David Cheney. The White House released a picture of Vice President Cheney and his wife Lynn with the boy, their sixth grandchild. Mary Cheney and Heather Poe live in Virginia, however, which enacted a constitutional amendment banning marriages of lesbian and gay couples and does not allow second-parent adoptions involving same-gender couples. Under that state's laws, Poe therefore has no legal connection to the child. According to Jennifer Chrysler, executive director of Family Pride, an LGBT advocacy group based in Washington, D.C., those laws leave the couple and their new son without the safety net enjoyed by heterosexual married couples. Nevertheless, she said, Vice President Cheney's newborn grandson and the boy's two mothers put yet another face on our families for the American public.
That's News Wrap for the week ending May 26, 2007. Written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Don Lupo.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
This is Queer Voices.
And this is Jennifer Renee.
And J.D. Doyle.
And we have with us in the studio two delightful people that I've known for quite some time. One is Chris Truax and George Zemanek. And they are female to male transgender. And a topic that not a lot of people know much about. And I wanted to bring them in tonight with sort of a transgender theme to talk about that. And also there's a number of support organizations for trans. The term trans men is what I use. But we'll ask them what they like to be called the most other than men. Like I like to be called woman. Okay. Chris, one of the things that has, before we get into some questions that go on there, one of the people in the trans community that passed away here not too long was Sandy O'Daniel. Did you know Sandy?
Yes, I did.
And tell us something about her, him.
Uh-oh.
I know.
Sandy was a pioneer for all of us guys. Most of us who start into any groups see him in all the groups, and he was one that you wondered what was he, because he was so male. One could never imagine him ever being the F part of FTM.
I agree with that.
Absolutely. And he was just a great leader for all of us. Gave us insight on testosterone, what to expect during, you know, chest surgery and changes and such. And he passed away about a month ago from, you know, various types of illnesses, and it's kind of left a hole. but in
like,
the guys.
But like, you know, like when Brenda Thomas passed away, some people have stepped forward to take leadership, and you know, that's what's important, that our community as well as all GLBT communities have people to step forward in that. And George, tell us something about the organization here, the support group here in Houston. Is what's it called?
The name of our organization is called STAG. It stands for Some Transgenders Are Guys, and it...
Oh, that's cute.
it originally started as an offshoot of CATS, or no, of TATS, sorry, and it started because we needed a group that was specifically for trans men, and we needed a group that just, you know, was designed to meet our needs.
Is the journey that different?
Yes and no, because, you know, there are certain things that we have in common with trans women, you know, coming out to your family, the risk of harassment and losing your job, and plus the, you know, that really awesome experience of, you know, self-awareness, self-discovery. But there are also, you know, there are certain things that are specific to trans men. You know, trans women want to grow breasts, but they're getting mastectomies, so that's a very different situation. We, you know, use a different hormone. We have different doctors we go to. So the journey, there are some things that's similar, but there's a lot that's very different.
What about psychological, the difference?
Chris? I think the changes we all, you know, undergo are alike. We talk in HTGA meetings a lot, and a lot of what the gals go through, us guys easily feel the same thing. So we're similar as far as the emotional aspects of it. It's the physical that is a lot different.
Yeah.
Do a lot of trans men go back into another closet, especially if they can pass easily? They tend to say, oh, now I'm a male, don't bother with me with my history.
Yeah. Yes, and in fact, that's one of my struggles right now, because in my in the teaching profession, I have to be I can't be open necessarily at my job because of what I do. And so when I realized that I was able to pass, and it, you know, I wasn't, people weren't able to identify me as transsexual, you know, just by looking at me, then I kind of jumped back in the closet and was like, you know, I'm just going to be a regular guy now. And heaven forbid somebody should ever find out that I was really a woman, or find out that I'm really transgender. So yeah, I did jump back into another closet, which didn't really work, because, you know, we're trans men, not biological men, and there's, you know, so there's certain differences that you just can't get past. And and plus, you know, I thought that I was doing a disservice to my community if I jump back into another closet. Then, you know, then it's going to be just like when I first transitioned and there was nobody to kind of show me the
no
way.
Mentors.
The growing awareness of transgender in America helped or hindered that coming out and staying out of that closet?
I think it's kind of helped, because now I can say the word transgender and more people know what I'm talking about, because there was, you know, a big magazine article recently about gender and transgenderism.
Yeah, Newsweek magazine, yeah.
Yeah, and there's, you know, when Julia came out, and that was all over the news. So it's people...
That's Sergeant Julia Oliver of the Houston PD.
Yes. And so now I can use the you know, people are more accustomed to the vocabulary. They know what a transsexual is.
Can you, either of you, speak about the acquiring the phenomenon of male privilege?
Oh, that's interesting. Go ahead.
I was stopped by a police officer about 3 months ago, and it is very funny how an officer is different when they treat a lady and how they treat a guy. I've been stopped as a female and I've been stopped as a guy. Huge difference. When you're a female, they ma'am you, give you
courtesy.
They don't curse. They're very you know,
professional,
very professional. But when it comes to the guys, they are cussing. Oh yeah, this is a bunch of bleep bleep, and oh yeah, I mean, it's almost like you're in a bar.
Yes, I agree.
It is, yes.
And have you noticed that in stores being waited on? And
yes, yes, and you know, people pay more attention to me now. That I mean, like if I go somewhere and like, you know, I get more attention. You know, I can. It's almost like people acknowledge my opinions, or my opinions are more valid now than when I was a woman. And
that's got to feel strange.
It does feel strange because, and then also I see how I'm very perceptive of how men treat women, and I see that out in public. And I try to, you know, I'm very, you know, try to be very gender neutral, like in how I treat people. And sometimes even women that I deal with, like if I go somewhere and I'm talking to a woman, and, you know, and she might be giving me like undue respect, you know, and it makes me feel very awkward, you know.
Undue is, if I'm not the right word, maybe for our society, new.
Yeah.
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 And what is weird for me is that I am used to my wife getting the check after we eat. So now with the male there, it's always, they look past her. They don't want to ask her what she wants to drink or anything. They automatically come to me with the check and with what do you want to eat or drink.
They assume you are dating deaf and dumb people.
And no, she's not. I know she's out there and hearing this. No, no, you're not, honey.
Yeah, be careful now.
And yes, guys do get in the doghouse more often. We have to, we have a very fine line, yes. We have a very fine line on what we can say and what we can't. Ladies seem to have a lot more privilege in saying things that may be off color.
We get to get away with a little bit more.
Yes,
with
you
a
do
smile.
And we get in trouble.
Now, you know, and that's very interesting because by the same token, as a transgendered female, we get ignored. If a couple of girls we go out some to a restaurant or something, we get ignored. You actually have to flag down waiters to take care of you.
Yeah.
So very different from the way it once was.
Mm-hmm.
Let me know, one of the other things, you know, you mentioned about STAG, which is how would you contact them? I want to, if there's an email address, I want to get this out at least one or two times.
Website,
in our website or telephone website number or something. That so out there may be someone, you know, with the awareness of the transition on the L word. There's been a lot of focus in on, and there's a new movie coming out on Sundance about transgender. I'm not real happy about it. Editorial opinion. However, it is about a female to male transitioning, and I just got it in the mail. So my question is, let's get the information. So if there's someone out there that wants to know more, how they can get in touch with you.
Okay, George and I head up STAG, and we're a group that meets on the fourth Saturday of the month at the Hack Center, which is 2520 Morgan. But for a starting point, STAG has a website, which I do, and it's at stag.transhouston.com. It is a affiliate of transhouston.com. And on a side note, I also have a website that I do, which is a personal diary of my, you know, transition from pre-T up until now and beyond. And that's at transitioningmail.com.
Good. That way someone...
A transblog.
Transblog. Yeah, someone out there who is interested, who maybe they don't want their girlfriend to know that they're interested in something, can go there and maybe talk with you or send you an email.
Right. STAG itself is good to find doctors for, you know, top surgery, links to books and stuff, and to find out where we meet, when we'll meet, and what we'll be doing when we meet at STAG. And the transitioning male site is more of a what you can expect going through the transition the transitioning process as a female to male transgender.
Medical and emotional?
Yes, the whole relationships, everything.
Now, as an organization, do y'all have other activities other than your regular support meetings? Do y'all have parties or something?
So you can go stag to your meetings.
So you can stag to your meetings? Oh, I knew that was coming. Yes, you can tag me.
Gladly.
I did want to mention we have a Yahoo group as well.
Okay.
Houston_stag@yahoogroups.com. But as far as events, we have a barbecue coming up, the training queue, and that's going to be June 16th at Chris's home. And Chris, what's the address?
Can we do that here or not?
The address? Yeah.
It's 15719 Oak Mountain. That's off of 290 and 6. And that's June 16th from 3 to 9.
Ah, that's also the day of special election. Just a footnote. Okay, so is there anything that I haven't asked that you'd like to get out?
Real quick, we've got about a minute.
stag.transhouston.com.
Good answer.
Good answer. That's perfect. One of the things that I was very curious about, the effect, and this is sort of a digression back there, what is the compared effect between the male hormone and the female hormone on you? Doesn't it affect you greatly?
Facial hair, body hair, certain things grow bigger, and the voice gets deeper.
And
hair falls out on your head.
What's the radio appropriate word for more?
If you've got to think about it, it's probably not going to work.
Well, you are male in that. And you're more active as a male, I guess you could
exactly.
say.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay.
Wink, wink.
Libido.
Thank both of you. We've been talking with Chris Truax and George Zamonic, and I want to both female to male transsexuals, and you can find out more about what's going on at
stag.transhouston.com.
Okay, and the other one?
transitioningmale.com.
Thank you very much, both of you. You're listening to Queer Voices. 2 seconds.
In late-breaking news, Moscow police arrested at least 30 people on May 27th, the 14th anniversary of the decriminalization of homosexual sex in Russia, as they attempted to gather signatures on a petition denouncing the ban of an LGBT pride march in the capital city. About 100 people had gathered in a park across from the office of outspokenly anti-queer Moscow Mayor Yuri Lushkov to collect signatures for the petition, which has already been signed by about 40 members of the European Parliament. Young militants from extreme right nationalist groups and several others identified with the Russian Orthodox Church shouted death to homosexuals as they pelted the peaceful petition gatherers with eggs and punched and kicked several until police belatedly moved in. Among those arrested were Pride organizer Nikolai Alexeyev and British activist Peter Tatchell, who was punched by an anti-gay demonstrator before being taken into custody. Also involved in the frightening melee were Vladimir Luxuria, the first transsexual member of the Italian Parliament, German MP Volker Beck, Dutch member of the European Parliament Sophie Infeldt, and Italian MEP Marco Cappato. A large contingent of international press on hand to cover the expected confrontation witnessed the chaos. We'll have more on this story next time on This Way Out. We'll learn how psychiatry recovered from homophobia and get with the beat of queer hip-hop. But first, Janet Mason explores the world of the early 20th century lesbians who inspired the hip-hop culture of their day.
There's something about an earlier era, intriguing and romantic, but quite possibly the most alluring thing is that it simply offers an escape. I have always been fascinated by the 1920s and 30s Parisian left bank, which laid claim to such lesbian literati as Gertrude Stein and Natalie Barney, known more for her philandering than for her writing, and the tortured but brilliant Juna Barnes, author of the classic Nightwood. These women, along with the rest of their circles, were public as lesbians, so much so that they were often referred to, and not always kindly, as Les Amazons by no less a writer than the famed Marcel Proust. Despite the fact that I am drawn to this era, I still can't help but be a realist. When a friend of mine, a hopeless and sometimes hapless romantic, says, "Don't you wish you had lived in the 20s and 30s in the Frisian Left Bank?" I find myself responding, "I don't know. They were a tortured bunch." Tortured, yes, but also intriguing. And this moment and place in history is noted for its female independence and its subsequent outpouring of lesbian and otherwise experimental body of influential literature that is with us still today. The openness of this era is captured in part in the recently published anthology The Golden Age of Lesbian Erotica, 1920 to 1940, edited by Victoria Brownworth and Judith Redding, 2007 Magic Carpet Books. The relative openness of the American expatriate writers living in Paris compared to the American writers who stayed in their own country and wrote about their clandestine lesbian lives is a stark contrast. Consider Renée Vivien, an expatriate in Paris who was born in London in 1877. Before her untimely death in her early 30s, Renée was captivated by another earlier era, that of Sappho and the Isle of Lesbos. All of Renée's poetry was written to her various loves, and most notably to the scandalous expatriate Texas heiress Natalie Barney, who, as legend has it, rode naked on a horseback through the streets of Paris and hosted one of the most popular literary salons of the era. Like her poetic idol, Sappho, Renée Vivien wrote about lesbian love in all its dimensions. The last four lines of Renée's poem, Lucidity, speaks to betrayal as much as it does to desire. Beneath feigned sweetness, a watchful reptile lies, dark as a sea without reflecting skies. The tombs are less impure than your bed, but the worst, O woman, only your mouth will quench my thirst. Gertrude Stein, who with her longtime partner, Alice B. Toklas, hosted another infamous literary salon, portrayed a different depiction of lesbian love in her epic Lifting Belly, which is excerpted in The Golden Age. Lifting belly praises, and she gives health and fragrance and words. Lifting belly is in bed, and the bed has been made comfortable. Lifting belly knows this. The stories in this collection, written by American writers who have stayed in their native country, are revealing of what lesbians living in this era had to do in order to survive. The stories are as varied as their characters. One woman stays in her small town and is blackmailed into marriage. Her lover flees to Greenwich Village and finds others like her. Beaded flappers have convenient open marriages that allow for indiscretions, and in one story, a woman passing as a man takes a job as a chauffeur for a married, bored, and wealthy matron. These stories were published in pulps and magazines catering to heterosexual men. However, these magazines and pulp fiction collections were undoubtedly read by lesbians at the time as well, women who may have been desperately searching for the clues to their own survival. One such passage was written by Dorothy Kravatsky in 1936 in her story entitled The Scent of Night. After the bored, married, wealthy matron gives her chauffeur a copy of Sappho, she commences to explain who Sappho is, only to have her chauffeur stop her and say, "I've been to college," I said softly. "I don't know much Greek, but my Latin is still pretty sharp." She looks surprised. "I live like this because I'd rather be a chauffeur or a mechanic than have to be some rich man's wife." Another telling moment comes at the end of Jazz Babies, written by Diane DeKalb Rittenhouse in the 1920s. The narrator, a beaded flapper in an open marriage whose love life is not what it seems, dreams of a time when we may be what we are, without laws to condemn us, without the need to hide, without having to pay the price of unfaithfulness, pandering to someone else's lusts in order to enjoy what is not lust, but love to me. As I read through these stories from another time, from the 20s and 30s, in a social context which is impossible for anyone queer to romanticize, I find myself wondering, could this really be true? Did this really happen? In reply, a voice inside me, rooted in reality, past and present, fiercely whispers, I hope so. With commentary on queer literature and life, this is Janet Mason for This Way Out.
Dr. Evelyn Hooker's Discovery, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Psychologist Dr. Evelyn Hooker conducted research in the 1950s, challenging the notion that homosexuality signaled mental illness. Having earned her doctorate from Johns Hopkins in 1932, she became a psychology researcher at UCLA. She decided to study gay men at the urging of a gay friend, Sam Fromm. He said, quote, "It is your scientific duty to study people like us, homosexuals who function very well and don't go to psychiatrists." In her study, she administered highly regarded personality tests to heterosexual and gay men. Her research found that the two groups were psychologically indistinguishable. At first, her conclusions caused heated debate amongst scientists, but in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association officially removed homosexuality from its list of psychiatric disorders. And while there was still much work to be done to destigmatize what it is to be gay, Evelyn Hooker had shattered one enormous myth. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Dustin Richardson.
Hi, this is John Cameron Mitchell, the writer-director of Hedwig and the Angry Inch and Short Bus. And you're listening to This Way Out, the international weekly radio magazine for all our sexually diverse communities.
Can hip-hop spark the queer revolution? The artists featured in this month's audio file are on the right tracks.
Welcome to a special all-gay hip-hop edition of Audio File. Hi, I'm J.D. Doyle.
And I'm Chris Wilson. We're starting off with a veteran of that genre, Torrey Fix. He's had 6 full-length albums, and his latest is called Code Red.
Now when I'm out at the club, and walking the streets, and I'll be open safety, I'll be done. And I have to be there, cause I ain't got none. It's safe, I just watch you walk by, and I make that face and go, damn. I wanna speak my mind, but the things I wanna say you wouldn't take too kindly. Don't mind me, I'm just the first 365 days of the week. They call me T, God, F to the X, and all day long, I'll dream about sex with you. Like Shazay to the JC, don't mind me, I'm just acting crazy.
Code Red is the best Torrey Fix CD out there right now. It's the CD that I'm most proud of and willing to share with any and everyone. It is the Torrey Fix CD I would recommend for anyone.
Party like it ain't party, good thing, so move out the way when I come to the door. Boys and girls, left and right, rock this in the evening or the daylight. You can 1-2-step or ATL stunt, break out the rock or take it back to the bunk. Chicken noodle soup with a soda on the side, I'll bob your head. In your ride, just turn the fuck up loud. Can you feel me? Cause I don't really think that you are hearing me. T-Fix with brand new heat and a brand new dance. Rock to this beat, but no matter, you really just do what you do, and that's whatever feels good to you. You can touch back down, up, or get work it, and that's the way we work it. Come on, and that's the way we work it. Work it out, the way we work it. Work it out, the way we twerk it. Twerk it out, the way we work it. Work it, that's the way we work it. Work it out.
Find out more about Torrey Fix and his album Code Red at www.torreyfix.com. That's www.torreyfix.com.
Revolution, love revolution, revolution, gay revolution.
Come on,
revolution, love revolution, revolution, gay revolution.
I got one chance here to have a clean slate, and I don't give a if you are gay or straight. Music of the people, that's what I'm told. Been driven by the music since 5 years old. This hand I'm dealt in the no limit holder on the day of my birth. Yo, I knew I was the chosen one to educate these misdirected minds, brainwashed by the church and the law at the same time.
A brand new hip-hop artist is Jose Ramirez Jr., but he goes by the name Big Nug. His debut CD is called La Revolution.
My album, La Revolution, is my first full-length album. It has 18 tracks produced by various artists and producers, and a lot of collaborations as well. We are focusing on issues such as homophobia in the media, as well as gay people not being represented in hip-hop, and this album kind of tackles all those issues.
Yeah, it's time to shake your thing. Yeah, whether you're sitting in your car, whether you're in the club, whether you're out at the bar, come on now, there ain't no reason just to sit there. Get up and shake. Come on, shake. I say, oh my baby, that look just drives me crazy. Tight beard, big chest. Oh yes, I must confess, these men they drive me wild. No longer in denial. We all love who we must love. No one should be put on trial. Protest me when all we want is our partners up in hand. While you are dropping bombs in someone else's foreign land, I want to live in peace. I want to spread some love. So here we go and grab a piece of what I got in store.
You can get more information about Big Nug and his album, La Revolution, at www.bignug.com. That's www.bignug.com.
Yo. 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 Double S. Double S. Yeah. Miseducated. Miseducated. But this is dedicated to the whole LGBT community. Yeah. I know y'all suffering out there. Wave that flag. Wave them high. Come on. Chomp with me now. Yeah. I'm waving the flag. Spreading the six-color love. Representing all stars. Never received a hug. This one is for you as much as it is for me. Hold your head to the stars and let your heart speak with thee. I'm waving the flag. Spreading the six-color love. Representing all stars. Never received a hug.
That artist is Ms. Fontaine, and she joined Tori Fix and Big Nug and 13 others on a compilation CD called Homo Revolution Tour 2007.
The tour was an actual event and went through the Southwest United States this spring. The CD also features this artist, known as JFP.
You say San Francisco values like it's a bad thing. Is it rather feed the homeless than buy a diamond ring? Well, I'll tell you how it is that we do what we do. See, you take care of me and I take care of you. We live in abundance, not scarcity. Cause my friend, there's enough for you and me. So reach out your hand and don't believe the hype. And this terror alert, cause we don't have to fight. When you breathe out, I breathe in. So if one of us dies, then no one wins. My heart, their head, your face, their skin. Connected we are again and again. If you lead me to water, I'll take a drink. But if I open up your eyes, will you start to think? Heaven or hell, it's up to you. Manifest your dreams and they will come true.
Find out more about this excellent gay and lesbian hip-hop compilation CD at www.homorevolution.com.
That's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at Post Office Box 66648, Houston, Texas, 77006, or by visiting our website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiofile.org.
Audiophile is produced by Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trenton. I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm J.D. Doyle. Keep listening.
Out about the atrocities on the people of the world that you would call disease. Two women, two men, or somewhere in between. It doesn't even matter because we all want the same thing.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Tanya Kane Ferry, Don Lupo, Rex Walkner with Phil Kelly, Graham Underhill, Janet Mason, Judd Proctor and Brian Burns with Dustin Richardson, and Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trenton contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. You can listen online to This Way Out anytime exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the link at the top of our website, This Way Out. kickingassetsfund.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and to direct charitable donations from listeners like you. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on KUMD Duluth, Minnesota, 2BBB Bellingen, New South Wales, WERU Bangor and Blue Hill Falls, Maine, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this very community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT.
Take your pain away. It's what you had to do. So fall on through to emotion. Take your pain away. Your slips on through. Hey, I wanna go home. Don't wanna be here alone. Yeah, I really can't stay.
This is JD, and I love her voice. That's Lucas Severa, who is the lead singer of a group called The Clicks. And that song is from L Tunes, Songs from the L Word. And I want to slip in a congratulations to This Way Out on their show number 1000.
This is Queer Voices.
And this is Jennifer Renee, and on the phone we have Chris Daly, director of the Transgender Law Center in San Francisco. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, Jennifer. How you doing?
I'm doing well this evening. We're sort of on a transgender theme tonight, and in the second hour, JD has the first segment of Queer Music Heritage featuring transgender artists.
Excellent, excellent. There's so many great artists breaking out in the scene right now. It should be a great show.
Speaking of such, one of the things that I had contacted you about was, for me, somewhat of a milestone, and that was Teresa Sparks.
Isn't she dynamite?
Absolutely. Tell us something about her, and for the audience who doesn't know, Teresa was elected the first police commissioner of San Francisco.
The first president of the San Francisco Police Commission, that's right.
Yes.
That's right. Teresa, you know, she really does play the role of kind of an older sister to a lot of folks in the movement right now. She's been doing this work for around a decade, focusing, you know, for a long time on enforcing our anti-discrimination statute through the Human Rights Commission, and then in 2004 joined the Police Commission after a number of years of working with a whole bunch of different people to create some reform of the police force itself to make it more transgender friendly.
Oh, it's been a long time in coming. She's been an activist for many, many years, hasn't she?
She most certainly has.
And tell us something about, to move over to the Transgender Law Center, tell us something about the Law Center and what y'all do there in San Francisco.
Sure. We started up in 2002, coming out of the National Center for Lesbian Rights here in San Francisco, and we provide direct legal services and public policy advocacy to transgender people and their families throughout California. So we're going strong. We're in our fifth year right now, and I just, you know, having a great time working with people all around the state and on different issues, folks all around the country, and really kind of transitioning the way in which transgender folks are embraced and supported by both California and the nation.
Is there anything that you're working on now that you'd like to talk to us about?
Sure. We've got a couple of really, really hot, exciting projects, one of which is our Transgender Economic Empowerment Initiative. And I say it's, you know, ours, but we're only one part of a larger collaborative with the LGBT Center here in San Francisco and Jewish Vocational Services. And then the city, for the first time ever, City and County of San Francisco, are huge funders in this work and have kicked down $300,000 last year, and we're expecting them to kick down another $300,000 in this year's budget cycle to make sure that transgender folks are, you know, kind of prepped for employment positions and then getting a lot of support as they move into jobs. We released a report in early 2006 looking at the high rates of unemployment and underemployment in San Francisco, which a city at that time had had an anti-discrimination statute for 11 years, and we still just saw incredibly high numbers of unemployment and underemployment among the folks that we surveyed.
And what kind of, other than, you know, with city support like that, I wish we had that in Texas, but it's coming,
you know,
it's coming, there is a future, we have a movement. Yes.
That's right.
And Houston is in the forefront of that here in Texas. One of the things that I was very interested in, and I'm somewhat of an historian of the transgender, is that in many ways the movement started there at Compton's Cafeteria.
It certainly was, particularly for organizing here in the Bay Area and then statewide, a major flashpoint when a riot happened at the Compton's Cafeteria just over 30 years ago now, because the owner and the police were trying to clear, you know, folks who were trans-identified and people who were actively participating as sex workers out of this all-night cafeteria one night. And, you know, like just like in so many other places, people got sick of it and stood up. And it really, you know, kind of sparked what we're now starting to see are the real roots and the branches of this pretty dynamic movement.
Yeah, I had always identified that as the moment at which San Francisco changed.
Transitioned.
Maybe that's a better way of putting it.
That's right, transition. I think what's so interesting is, even with that long history of activism, you know, we still see people having so many challenges in their day-to-day life. I think that, you know, our Good Jobs Now report really just tried to demonstrate that all of the work that had been done had built a strong foundation, but we hadn't yet gotten over the hump of making rights and so on and so forth real in people's everyday lives. And I really think that that's what this project offers, to really kind of move forward and make sure folks are, you know, in sustainable jobs and making, you know, kind of career moves for themselves. And we're just really, really excited about it.
Now, since our show goes throughout the Pacifica network, if someone needed to contact you there in San Francisco, how would they do it?
Sure, they can do it directly through our website, which is www.transgenderlawcenter.org, or they can always just give us a call, 415-865-0176.
Great. As far as, we've talked a little bit about San Francisco, what about California statewide? What kind of activities are going on there?
We're just coming off the heels of our second annual Transgender Leadership Summit down in Los Angeles, and TLC has been a big part of convening that for the last 2 years. This year we had over 200 activists and allies come together just to talk about what do we want the statewide movement to look like, and to do a lot of networking among people who are doing local work in their own communities and to forming into a statewide movement, and then also just looking at skills building and, you know, really making sure folks have the tools to take their work to the next level.
How is the high public profile of Christine Daniels of the LA Times sort of brought focus on transgender issues there in California? Has that been helpful in people sort of looking at transgender?
Well, wasn't that a beautiful essay that she wrote? And I think that, you know, it really is opening the dialogue for folks who did not think they knew someone who was transgender. I was talking to Helen Carroll, who runs the National Center for Lesbian Rights, Homophobia, and Sports Project, about what a national figure she is in the sports community and how well-known she is and what the kind of potential for long-term change is. You know, and she was just so courageous and so bold. And, you know, I thought addressed the issue in a way that really welcomed people to kind of embrace her as Christine. And I think we are going to certainly see a changed tenor, if nothing else, in sports coverage just because of how well-known she is.
Oh, absolutely. I was thrilled to see that and to read that article. It was well done. It expressed a lot of feelings that most of us transgenders have when it comes to telling our story in a way that is understandable and affects and people can sense the change in how it is. What has been the effect of other things like the Newsweek publication that had a lot of transgender issue or gender issue in it? It's sort of the gender issue, if you will. How did that affect, or did you hear any ripple or see any ripple of that in San Francisco?
You know, we saw more of it in our work in Los Angeles. A number of the people that we work with in Los Angeles were featured either in the article itself or in some of the photos in the print or electronic version. And so we're just seeing a real increased excitement for folks to get out and make sure that their story is being told. And I think that plus the work that MSNBC has been doing, they just did a piece on transgender youth, not too dissimilar from the piece that Barbara Walters did. Excuse me, and the number of documentaries that are coming out, and as we move into LGBT film festival season, I think we're going to see a bunch more kind of cutting edge documentaries coming out. I just think people are feeling more and more empowered, and that the stories are being told in a way that's true to them. One of the things that we're doing in Los Angeles is we're working with FTM Alliance and Lotus and a couple other local groups down there on some healthcare access work to really just talk about getting some community clinics in Los Angeles, up to five, you know, throughout the county. It's a huge county, up to five who are offering specific transgender services. And one of the things that we started off with in that campaign is just doing a bunch of mini documentaries that are available on YouTube, and really just kind of allowing people that space to kind of create some media and be their own media and really, you know, talk about what it means to get good health care and what it means to do organizing within the community. So folks who are interested in that can just go to YouTube and look for FTM Alliance of Los Angeles, and you should see three and soon our fourth mini documentary that's coming out of that work.
That's great. I'll look at that myself. That sounds very interesting. Yes, definitely. Because one of the things, as far as a transgender person is concerned, getting health care, affordable health care for anyone is difficult to begin with, but for transgenders it's even more so because of prejudice and built-in ambiguities in the system that will eliminate us because of the difference in how our medical care is delivered, but also the awareness that I know that many people don't understand and haven't heard is the aging transgender. Once we get into grow older and enter that our twilight years, if it will, that there's no place for transgenders in our society.
It's very true that a lot of the assisted care facilities and the long-term care facilities, folks haven't been trained. There is some really exciting work being done by some of the social workers involved in that system in terms of educating the people in their profession. And we are advice and counsel attorney at TLC, Ben Lunine, just created an advanced healthcare directive that addresses some of the very specific issues that transgender folks will go through, you know, when they're injured or, you know, incapacitated or unfortunately after they've died, to make sure that everybody's identity is being respected. And so that's something that we're going to have available on our website soon. So folks who are concerned about these issues and want to make sure that their wishes are well known, should go ahead and download one of these. The one that we've created is specifically California oriented, but it's something that could probably be easily adapted to other states.
Oh, great. Well, we have about a minute left. Is there anything that specifically you'd like to bring up and want to let the public know?
Well, I'm sure folks know this, but, you know, the National Center for Transgender Equality and the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force have been doing amazing work around the country in terms of local statutes in different states, and we're now up to, I believe, 12 states that have statewide anti-discrimination provisions, which there were only two when I started this work in 2001. And I think that momentum is really kind of behind the introduction in the Congress of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And so, you know, there's great things happening in California. What's so exciting is because of all the great allies across the country, we're just seeing movement everywhere.
All right. Chris Daly, Director of Transgender Law Center in San Francisco, I appreciate you coming on our show tonight, and thank you for this wonderful information. Keep up the good work.
You too. Good to talk to you.
All right. Thank you. This is Queer Voices.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Walensky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Hey! Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? We are continuing with the Frog Pond Art Series, Living Legends. We would like to present for you the fun and irrepressible Christine Jorgensen.
Well, hello there. Welcome to my world. Won't you come on in? Miracles, I guess. Oh, they still happen now and then. Step into my show. Leave your cares behind. Welcome to my show. Built with you in mind.
Now, yes, welcome to my show. And if you're interested in transgender music, then it was indeed built with you in mind. This is Queer Voices on KPFT, and this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and I think I have a special show for you this month, focusing on transgender artists and performers. Later in the show, I will feature an interview with Terry Noel, one of the performers in the early 60s from the famous Jewel Box Review. And then jump to the present to hear from Serafina Maricino, a founder of the all-transgendered rock band Lipstick Conspiracy. I open this show with Christine Jorgensen, and many of you know that she was the first person to gain widespread attention for having sexual reassignment surgery, or SRS. Starting out as a young man from New York City, George Jorgensen Jr. left for Denmark in late 1952, and when returning in February of 1953 as Christine, she was a media sensation. For over 30 years, she was popular on the lecture circuit and known for being an author and a poised and articulate speaker. Now, I read her very interesting autobiography and knew that she also did nightclub engagements. But until last year, I never suspected that a couple of those shows had been captured. That was done by record producer David Cunard. David grew up in England and was an actor, and early in his career also got involved in the recording industry. In 1967, he moved to Los Angeles and in 1975 founded AEI Records, a label devoted to musical theater and cabaret artists. Being a fan of gay musicals, I already knew this, as I have several of those recordings in my collection. I was very pleased when he contacted me last summer, having seen my extensive coverage on my site of Christine Jorgensen, and he told me that he was getting ready a recording of her nightclub show. Of course, I was fascinated, and that project was completed and uploaded to iTunes in December. I thought it would be interesting to hear how this project came about and interview David. But before we get to that, let's hear just a snippet of Christine in her show. It's a show of music, stories, and impressions, and here's her intro to a very logical song choice.
But I'm so glad to be here, and it's really grand here in the L.A. area, and wonderful audiences. Now, none of you were aware that I was a singer, right? Well, let me tell you, when she heard me sing, Beverly Sills told me it made her very, very nervous. I believe that this is an era or a place where one should be having a wonderful time. Put your troubles outside. Believe me, they'll be waiting for you there when you get out there to meet them. But I always think the nightclub should be fun. We don't have to be the greatest performers. I'm not the greatest performer in the world at all. But it's fun. And if you have a good time and I have a good time, then we've all had a good time together. And I think that's what life is all about. But you know, many years ago, when I was playing at the Latin Quarter in New York, a beautiful show opened on Broadway. It was called Flower Drum Song. In it, Pat Suzuki sang this wonderful tune, which became my theme song. See if you remember it. I'm a girl, and by me that's only great. I am proud that my silhouette is curvy, that I walk with a sweet and girlish gait, with my hips kind of swivelly and swervy. I adore being dressed in something frilly. When my date comes to get me at my place, out I go with my Joe or John or Billy, like a filly who is ready for the race. And I have a brand new hairdo with my eyelashes all in curl. I float as those clouds on air do. I enjoy being a girl. When men say I'm cute and funny, and my teeth aren't teeth but pearls, I just lap it up like honey. I enjoy being a girl.
Very appropriately, that was a bit of I Enjoy Being a Girl. And let's hear now from David Cunard how the recording came about. Tell me about the project to make Christine's cabaret show available.
In 1985, there were a number of cabaret ladies playing around Los Angeles, one of whom was Vivian Blaine. And Miss Blaine was the first celebrity of any kind to do public service announcements for AIDS, so APLA. And I ran a small label called AEI, and it was thought it would be a nice idea to record some of these ladies. Vivian Blaine was one. And then I saw that Christine was going to be appearing at what was then Studio One, a discotheque in what is now West Hollywood. And I don't recall exactly how I contacted her, but anyway, I did. And she was delighted at the idea that it would be recorded. And so we set up the recording equipment and recorded two evenings. And that's how it started. And then after that, we re-recorded it at a restaurant called the Frog Pond. And that was right in the heart of Silver Lake, which is a predominantly gay area. And Chris did a couple of shows there, and we recorded those. And that's what you hear on the tape.
And how did you get interested in recording Christine?
Well, I suppose just the fact that she was a novelty. Small labels like my own thrived on unusual projects. AEI was the first company to ever release London cast recordings in the United States. And there's a young man whose name is Alan Eichler, who represented a number of older ladies who had, you know, maybe just passed their prime in stardom. And he initially had brought Vivian Blaine to me. So there was a little circuit. And, of course, knowing who Christine was and that she was doing her show out here just seemed to be an obvious choice.
How did her show go over?
At the Frog Pond, it went over very, very well. And that was the second time. The Studio One, and I doubt if you or your listeners have ever been there, they had a small theater there. Well, I say small by comparison to a regular theater, but it was very big for a cabaret space, and it wasn't really intimate enough. And some of her material fell rather flat, I'm afraid. And it wasn't particularly well rehearsed. She, of course, had been doing a lot of material on the lecture circuit, talking about sexuality, transgenderism, and so on. And she'd been away from the cabaret stage for some time. So this was a sort of way, in a way, a comeback for her. Not that she'd ever been away, but a comeback in terms of cabaret. And maybe some of her material was just a bit old-fashioned for what was a very young group at a discotheque. But at the restaurant, at the Frog Pond, which is a much smaller, intimate space, that was very successful, and they loved her.
For such a specialty niche market, it can be cost-prohibitive to release CDs. So what was your approach to the marketing?
When iTunes came along, I approached them. Initially, they weren't interested in independence to start with, but 18 months ago, they said, yes, we would be interested, and uploaded some of the material. I think it's about 25 or 30 albums, including Christine's, on iTunes.
What other gay-related recordings have you uploaded to iTunes?
Boy Meets Boy, of course, and Joseph McCarthy is alive and living in Dade County.
Charles Pierce?
Oh, pardon me, Charles Pierce, yes, that's, thank you for reminding me. Didn't come to mind because I didn't actually produce it, but a friend of mine did, and he had the label Wanda Records.
Any plans for additional recordings?
Well, with regard to Christine, she did do an interesting part, which I had not considered 20-plus years ago. Towards the end of her show, after doing the singing and everything else, a few jokes, and she did a lot of quick changes as well, which is very clever, she did a question and answer sequence, which apparently she had perfected in her lectures to students when she was lecturing on sexuality. And she learned to deal with all kinds of people. And she said, well, even though there's alcohol being served, she would do it because she knew that she could handle any questions which were maybe not so proper. And that's a very interesting part of what she did, was to answer questions about how she felt about gay life and so on. She actually wasn't... I can't say that she was in the forefront of gay rights at all. She thinks she had very ambivalent feelings about gay men. I mean, she was surrounded by them. And this is a whole generation ago.
Well, hopefully David will proceed with the project for the interview recording. I'd love to hear it. But you can find the nightclub recording on iTunes. It's called Christine Jorgensen, I Enjoy Being a Girl, An Evening of Songs and Laughter. Before we leave this segment, here's just a little more of it. This time she's doing an impression of Marlene Dietrich.
I'll see what the boys in the back room will have, and tell them I'm having to say. I'll see what the boys in the back room will have, and tell them I cried, and tell them I sighed, and tell them I died of the same. And when I die, don't send me flowers or rotten pictures in a frame. No, see what the boys in the back room will have, and tell them I cried,
and tell them I sung, and tell them I died of the same.
Christine Jorgensen had her sex change in 1952, and for my next guest, that process started in 1965. That story is very interesting, but also is her earlier history. Her name is Terry Noel, and she was a performer in the famous Jewel Box Revue, and also at the 82 Club in New York City. She was therefore a professional female impersonator. A note about the Jewel Box Revue. Before Stonewall, there were a number of well-known drag clubs, such as Finocchio's in San Francisco, the Club My Oh My in New Orleans, and the 82 Club in New York. But there was really only one touring company of female impersonators that became famous, and that was the Jewel Box Revue. It started in 1939 at a club in Miami, and in the early 1940s started touring the country, billed as 25 Men and a Girl. The company lasted until 1975, although there have been others since then using that name. I was delighted last year when one of the Jewel Box Revue performers, Terry Noel, contacted me, and we've been corresponding ever since. I simply could not pass up getting her story captured for this show. Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in a small town in Kentucky, and actually it's a good thing because I wasn't mistreated, you know, by the folks who lived there. A lot of people I hear about were mistreated in their youth, and I wasn't. So I was lucky.
Tell me about your start as a female impersonator.
In 1958, I won a drag contest at a local bar where I was hanging out. First time I'd ever done any such thing as that. And somebody handed me a magazine that had the address of the Jewel Box Revue in New York. And so I wrote to them on a lark and sent them pictures. And then they called me like 2 weeks later and asked me to join the show. So I joined the show in Asbury Park, New Jersey, early in 1959. And I was with them for, oh, I guess 15 months until I landed in New York City. I really hated the road because the Jewel Box Revue was a traveling show.
Did you have the name Terry Noel then? Or is that your real name?
No, stage name? It's my stage
name. How did you pick that name?
Well, Terry is my actual middle name, and it was my mother's maiden name. Noel was taken from a guy I used to know who was French-Canadian. And his name was Noel, so I just took that.
Human nature being what it is, people are going to be curious about your age. Do you mind sharing that?
No, I'll be 71 at the end of the summer.
And what was your performing experience up to the point where you joined the Jewel Box Revue?
Absolutely nothing. I had never performed anything except piano, because I played piano all my life, and but I never performed, you know, if you're asking about performing in nightclubs or anything, nothing like that. I played for church, and I played for, you know, various activities at school and so on, but nothing that you could call a professional performance, no.
That's kind of amazing that they hired you.
Well, I wasn't hired as a performer. I was hired as window dressing. I was hired as a showgirl, and all you have to do is stand there and sing and parade around, you know, and participate in the production numbers and so on, you know. So it was an easy gig, really.
What did you do in the JBR? What kind of act did you have?
In the JBR, I was a showgirl, like I said, and it was centered around production numbers, actually. We had some acts, some singing and dancing and so on, acts, and they did that, and then we would do production numbers as well. And I was one of the showgirls, just in the background, like, and then when we were in New York, in Brooklyn, at Maxix, which was the most beautiful club we ever played, we formed a singing trio, and I was one of the girls who sang, so we had great fun doing that.
How did you move from the JBR to the 82 Club?
I got really tired of the travel, like I said, living out of a suitcase and traveling on a bus all over the country. And when we played New York at Maxix, someone introduced me to Kit Russell, who was the director of the 82. And I happen to have a photo from the Jewelbox Review, which showed me in a scene with the male dancers, where I was sitting on their knees and so on. And it reminded her of herself, Kit Russell. And so she asked me to join the show, and boy, was I glad to do so.
Okay, we're going to take a music break, so I found an appropriate song. It's by an English actress and comedian named Hermione Baddeley. She starred in movies such as Room at the Top and Mary Poppins, but was more known for her role as Mrs. Naugatuck on the TV show Maude. In her stage appearance, she sang many comedy songs, such as the one I'm playing from her 1961 album, A Taste of Hermione Baddeley.
I changed my sex a week ago today. I don't know what the dressmaker will say. For whichever way it was, she'll have to alter it, because my underpants were cut a different way. I changed my sex just 7 days ago. I don't quite know how much it's going to show. It's all the same to me, whether I'm a he or she, but my friend is very curious to know. I suppose I ought to notify Her Majesty's officials that my passport may be open to some doubt. For although I haven't changed my name or altered my initials, my particulars have now gone down the spout. If I'm thrust into the army, I shall have to change my plans to conform with such demands as may be made. For it might not be so easy to explain just what I am when I'm standing to attention on parade. Yes, just 7 days ago it came to light. I don't think it will matter, but it might. I'm bewildered, I confess, by the rumors in the press that Christine intends to have it out tonight.
Again, Hermione Baddeley and I Changed My Sex a Week Ago Today. Back to the interview with Terry Noel. Of the folks you work with at the 82 Club and JBR, what percent of them would you say were gay?
I would say 98%. Of course, sure. There were a couple who were not, who were just impersonating for the money, you know, just and went home to their wives and so on. But, oh, most of them, I would say, were gay.
Mm-hmm. And what percent were transgendered?
See, there were no people transgendered in the Jewel Box in the late 59 and early 60 that I was aware of. At the 82, there were, I guess, maybe three, only three. Because actually it was a fairly new phenomenon then, you know, and people kind of looked down on it, actually, you know, like mutilation of yourself and so on.
Also, I wondered if the venues would have considered transgender performance as a kind of a contradiction of the illusion.
They might have, but those who were going, who were taking hormones and things sort of hid it. You know, it was common knowledge, but not to the management. Because the management was very strict on us at the 82 Club. You know, there was no leaving the club in drag or anything. It was, if you did that, you'd just kiss your job goodbye. Except on New Year's Eve.
And why did they do that?
Why did they do that? Well, because there were laws about it. And even though, you know, the club was managing the police pretty well, we just couldn't slap them in the face like that, you know. But on New Year's Eve, somehow we would be able to get away with it.
Did you experience any police harassment or problems?
No, never. There was a time, though, there toward the end, where I was already in the process of my transition, my SRS, and where I came home at 4 o'clock, like we always did from the Club 82, and I got out of a cab, and I ran up my steps, and a police car stopped, and two cops got out and chased me up the steps until I told them that I worked at the 82 Club, and I was coming home from work, that's all. And then they just let me go.
Describe a typical JBR show.
Oh, Well, it would start out with a production number where we were sort of presented ourselves to the audience, and then there would be a couple of acts, and then we would do another production number, maybe a couple of acts, and we'd do a finale. It was about a 2-hour show, maybe a little over, maybe 2 hours each time. I don't know exactly what you want to know.
What was it, their original music or songs of the day? Or
we took music from, for instance, we did a number called American in Paris, and we used Gershwin's music for that. The people who did their own acts, now they did the standards of the day and so on in their acts. But the production number were mostly things that had been done, you know, before, and were maybe taken from a Broadway show or something.
And it was all real singing.
Oh yeah, we had a band every time. We never lip synced anything. Nothing was lip synced. Nothing was recorded. We always had a live band, even at the 82, and we would have a house band at every theater we went to.
The music that you've been hearing in the background throughout this interview is Terry on piano, and I'm pleased that she sent me a recording of her playing and singing. Here is her doing the song, Lies of Handsome Men.
I believe in star signs, and I believe in film romances. I believe in fantasy, and I believe with just one glance he's crazy for my eyes. 'Cause I believe the lies of handsome men. I believe in witchcraft, and I believe in Cinderella. I believe in gypsies, and I believe I cast a spell that sends him to the skies. 'Cause I believe the lies of handsome men. Somewhere in a corner of my mind, I'm not a fool, completely blind. But even though he's hooked me on his line, I find the pleasure's been mine. I believe in love songs. They seem to know just what I'm feeling. I believe Prince Charming. I never guess he's double dealing. How my spirits rise, believing in the lies of handsome men. Sometimes in a dark and quiet place, the truth and I meet face to face. And even if His Highness disappears, I keep some stunning souvenirs. So I believe in heroes. I expect that happy ending, wishing on some rainbow. I pretend he's not pretending. Someday I'll get wise, but right now I need the light of handsome men.
Again, that was Terry Noel. Do you do much performing these days?
No, I have a little talent on the piano, and I play around at some retirement homes here, you know, captive audiences, so they can't get away until I'm through. And I sing a little bit, and I don't know, it has to be a captive audience.
How many were in the cast of the JBR?
Well, it's advertised as 25 men and a girl.
that many female impersonators, was there competition or was it a family affair?
It was pretty much easy go because we were all under the same stress, you know. It was just get the job done, you know.
So you joined the JBR in 59?
Mm-hmm.
And stayed with them how long?
About 15 months, I would say, and then joined the 82 Club.
And how long did you work for that?
Until 1966. I had my SRS surgery in September of 65, and I stayed with the show. They were kind enough to let me do that until I found an office job, which was in February of 66, and then I left the show for good.
Did you say, okay, I'm going to get my surgery and then leave show business? What was your plan?
They didn't want me in the show after I had the surgery, but it was my plan to leave anyway because I didn't want to be in the show after my surgery, actually. I wanted to get a regular life, you know, fade into society, and that's what I did.
At what age did you realize you wanted to be a woman?
I can't ever remember a time when I didn't want to be female, even when I was a little kid. And then when I was about 12, I guess, 11, 12, something like that, I was in the restroom getting some water to wash the green boards in my school for my teacher. And Mr. Morgan, our basketball coach, walked out of the shower totally nude. He was the first adult male I'd ever seen nude. And I've never been the same since. And it just sort of progressed beyond that. I tried very hard to be a gay man. I really did when I learned the facts of life. Tried hard, you know, but here's the thing. I never could sleep with a gay man. The instant a gay man showed interest in my male anatomy, it was like somebody turned off the light. I wasn't interested. I wanted a regular Joe, and I wanted to be treated like a female. I have a lot of gay friends, and I adore being with them. But when it comes to, you know, down to the nitty-gritty, I want a regular Joe.
When you moved to New York and joined JBR, did you also start living as a woman?
No, it took me 3 years to make the decision to have the surgery. No, I didn't think about it for the first couple of years until there were a couple of people that I knew were having hormones, getting hormone injections and so on, with a famous doctor there who did that sort of thing. And it just sort of seemed like what I should do because of the way I wanted to live my life, you know.
I understand, and I think this is fascinating, that your mother took out a loan to help pay for your surgery and arranged for your birth certificate to be changed.
God bless her. She certainly did. She went to, I don't know, one of those, you know, storefront loan places, and got me some money because I was coming up short on the price, you know, because when I had my very first surgery, it was illegal to do in the States at that time. So what I had to do was pay the hospital administrators under the table to allow the surgery to occur. So it took some money, you know, and I didn't have two dimes to rub together, actually, and on $65 a week, you can imagine. And so she did go and get a loan and help me pay for it. Yeah, and then after it was over, the doctor wrote me some papers, and I saw a psychiatrist for about 10 minutes, and he wrote me a paper, too. And my mom took him down to the county clerk and put him on the table, and within a week or so, I had an official birth certificate with no addendums to it, so that there's nothing on there to say that I am transgendered. Now, I know people who are struggling to get something like that. I never had to go to court or anything. They just did it for her.
Yeah, I was going to say, I had the impression it was much more difficult.
Oh, yeah.
Even possible.
some places it is impossible and will always be impossible.
How did you transition from being a showgirl to an office girl?
Well, I had already been trained in office procedure before I'd ever joined the Jewelbox Review. And I already had office skills. And I knew I could get a job. I really did know that. That's the one area where I was most confident in all that.
And office work became your career?
Oh, yeah. I worked in several places around New York. I worked in Rockefeller Center. I worked on Wall Street. I worked a lot of places. And then I left New York in 1969. I had another surgery in 68, which was the real surgery that made everything right for me as a woman. And then I left in 69 and moved south.
And you moved from New York City to Virginia Beach and got married.
Yeah, I did. I went to Virginia Beach, and I met a very nice man there. And we were together for 14 years, and we were married. We lived together 3 years first, and then we were married. And he brought his son to live with us from his first marriage. The son was in Europe, so we brought him over and had our little family there until 85 when we were divorced. And my husband never knew my past. He never knew that I had been a male. He still doesn't know, and neither does my stepson. Now, I don't know if that's of any importance or not, but it seems to freak people out, and it's interesting, I think, to them.
I have the impression that you've lived totally as a woman most of your life, and now you're being more public about your story. What are your thoughts on sort of coming out of that closet?
Well, here's the thing. I've reached an age where I don't want to be totally exposed. I'm going to be in semi-stealth the rest of my life. But I guess I have something to share, you know. And that's what I'm trying to do, just a little bit, you know. Just let people know that you can have a long and successful life after surgery. And you don't have to be in showbiz to do it. That's really what I'm trying to do. You know, I have no visions of grandeur here about anything concerning me. I just want people to know that you can live a good life.
Do you have any message you would like to get across to my listeners?
I don't know. Things are so open now, you know, and people don't have to hide themselves, and don't have to be ashamed of who you are like I was, and I'm so miserable with it all, and I don't think I have any message for them. I mean, any information you want is on the internet. You don't have to, you know, do like I did and do everything by yourself. You can get information and proceed to wherever it is that you want to go.
And this is a good time to invite you to check out my website. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Again, that's at www.queermusicheritage.com. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper every Friday night, Saturday morning from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude. Up next, Lipstick Conspiracy.
Crossing the Bay Bridge in the midday light. In your hat and shade, you look like Jackie O. We're heading to a brunch that's gonna change our lives. It'll take a while, but it won't be slow. Welcome to the gender frontier, baby.
Yes, welcome to the gender frontier. That's one of the tracks from A Perfect Alibi, the latest album by the San Francisco band Lipstick Conspiracy. They've been attracting a lot of attention as a very talented and also all-transgendered rock band. The band was founded by Serafino Maricino and Tori Tate, who were quickly joined by Marilyn Mitchell and Shauna Love. They all write, arrange, and sing, which gives their music a variety of influences. Their first release in 2004 was a five-song EP called Don't Tell a Soul, and their first full-length album came out in 2006 called A Perfect Alibi. My interview is with Serafino Maricino. Tell me about the new album.
The new album, A Perfect Alibi, is a romp through many decades of pop music to arrive at what we think is an updated version of power pop music. This is something that is definitely uniquely us and uniquely Lipstick Conspiracy.
How did the band get started?
Tori and I met online. Somehow it came out that the two of us were both musicians, and I had been interested in starting a all-transgender rock band, largely because when I moved to San Francisco, I assumed that there would just be so much talent out there that every other corner bar would have a piano player and a tranny torch singer. I just kind of assumed that. So I didn't find as many musicians as I would have liked, and I was quite surprised. And the more that I looked around, the more I realized this is something that needed to be done, something that should be done, something I'm surprised hadn't been done. Tori and I had met, and let's put a band together. And it so happens that one of her close friends, Marilyn, the two of them didn't even know that they were musicians. And three of us met at a bar in the Mission and decided this is a great idea.
Tell me a little about the members of the band.
Let's see, Tori's British. She's in software. Marilyn teaches at State here in San Francisco. Shauna is a maintenance person by day. See, Natalie is actually unemployed. She's just recently joined the band. I shouldn't say she's unemployed. She changed careers to move up here and join the band, and she's still getting settled in. And I am self-employed. I do a lot of contract web work. I clerk for a legal attorney. I work for a psychologist, and that's about it.
Musically, where do you all fit in?
Okay, I play guitar and sing, and Tori plays keyboards and sings, and Natalie plays drums. Shauna plays bass most of the time, and Marilyn tends to play more lead guitar than, say, me or Shauna, and I tend to sing more songs than any of the others. I sing like five on the new album. Marilyn does three, and Shauna and Tori each do two.
What is your stage show like?
Stage show? Our stage show, we have a lot of fun on stage, and that's what we've been told is evident, that we are obviously friends, we are obviously enjoying ourselves, almost as if we don't even care that there is an audience. But we do entertain, but we don't think of ourselves as an act. I mean, there's no shenanigans, chicanery, or anything like that to indicate that this is rehearsed.
Other than no shtick.
There's no shtick, yeah, exactly. We kind of have an image that is polite and professional, but not necessarily squeaky clean. For example, I tend to introduce most of the songs. I tend to do most of the talking. I've introduced the song I Won't Go, which Marilyn sings, as saying, you know, the political views of the singer do not necessarily reflect the views of the rest of the band. Because the song basically is saying, you know, she's not interested in this person and she can't be had. And, you know, it's kind of funny to imply that, well, actually, she may not be, but...
I get it. Tell me more about the song I Won't Go.
That's definitely a classic Marilyn Hit Factory song. She was she was seeing somebody who she was quite, let's just say, not interested in prosecuting the relationship farther, and this individual ended up getting a little difficult with her. Just a lot of it was just kind of the heartstring tugs and the usual BS. And as a result, she wrote a song. She was quite angry with him, and she ended up writing the entire song herself in a weekend. But that's about it. It was definitely a I'm not interested in you anymore kind of song.
It's a strong song and a good song to start an album with.
Well, it also, to start the album, I mean, the stereotype is the trannies are easy. You know, I mean, all you got to do is buy us a drink and we're going to put out. A lot of people make that assumption, and it's a good song to open up because it does obliterate that stereotype right away.
Even though I like you, I won't go all the way with you.
You
your audience?
Well, that's actually quite difficult to pin down. In the early days, our audience was a lot of Bay Area, more artsy, queer kind of sorts, sex workers, fellow musicians, drag queens, etc. And we anticipated that every transgender individual in the country would not only hear about us, but would clamor to be a part of all of this. And we were quite surprised to find quite a bit of bifurcation within the community. Those that are out and proud aren't necessarily interested in making the association, you know, because they've cut and run, they've transitioned, you know, they're stealth, whatever. And then those that are just coming out of the closet but don't want anybody else to know are not interested in being seen in public. We don't play at just traditional, I mean, we play all over the place. We don't restrict our shows to just queer audiences. So it's pretty much anything goes.
That reminds me of a comment another trans artist made to me of a similar problem where it was hard to sell her CD because it was hard to get transgendered people to come to the shows because they were closeted and didn't want to come out. So how do you reach people who don't want to be seen?
Well, we've recognized that the trans audience may not exist at, say, for lack of a better description, market. I mean, a market that is, you know, they follow us around, that kind of a thing. You know, a true fan base where, you know, you buy the posters, you wear the T-shirt, you show up to every show, you know, like following the Grateful Dead or something. We have quite a few trans folks that are friends of ours, that are fans, that are involved, and there's always some tranny in the audience I've never met before in my entire life. That always happens. But I figured that would have been a larger contingent of our audience. That just doesn't seem to be the case. Over time, people would show up for a show and say, "Oh, you guys are great." I mean, I knew people that had, you know, gone out in their first night dressed ever to one of our shows and was talking with us afterwards, saying that they're going to be a fan for life, and then literally having them fall off the face of the earth and within a couple of months. And it's like, what happened? And that's the nature of the community. For those that are committed, that say, you know, well, this is my life path. You know, I am transgender. And then moving in that direction is one thing versus somebody who is just kind of part-timing it, I guess you can say, where it's like, well, I'm not sure what I'm doing. I do this to express myself. This is all about gender, not about sex or whatever else. It's reconciling the two halves of that that truly make it kind of a conundrum. You know, I mean, it's like the individual on the spectrum that are at the extremes are those that we find in the audience versus those that are kind of in the middle.
Do you think being an all-trans band has helped or hindered the band's career?
Both, definitely. We've gotten gigs and notice and whatnot largely because people say, oh, an all-tranny band, this will be interesting. And then also, we've been dismissed. You know, it's like, well, this isn't, you're not a real rock band. And it's like, wait a second, because that's exactly what the problem is that we are both. And we can take the angle that we are, you know, we're just, as we say, you know, we're a rock band that happens to be all trannies. We enjoy converting people who automatically assume that we're going to be some train wreck act, you know, something along the lines of what they perceive us to be. And then realizing, oh my God, they can actually play their instrument.
I understand that not all of the band members are out as transgendered at work. Could you talk about the difficulties of trying to preserve a paycheck while being in a band seeking exposure?
Yes, Rachel Swan from the East Bay Express mentioned that was going to be our biggest obstacle overcoming that. And for the most part, I mean, you can argue it, I think, politically, in the sense of, you know, how can you do this when you're in the closet versus you can argue it also from serendipity or opportunity. It really doesn't matter until it really does matter. Marilyn, for example. I guess I shouldn't talk about any of the others. I should just put this into my own personal experience. I'm out. I've changed my name, etc. I'm on the fast track to transition and so on. So I am legally who I am. Everybody's life choices are their own. And as it being a matter of I am this person some of the time and I am this person the rest of the time, whether that percentage is little or large, if that is hastened by the success of the band, no one in the band is afraid of that. Versus it's not a matter of keeping it in just staying in the closet because of just pure opportunity. It's just a matter of recognizing I don't need to do this, so I'm in no hurry to do so.
Have any of the members of the band had SRS?
That is a question that is probably best unanswered. Largely because, from a political standpoint, it is the band's policy, if you will, to not draw those lines as a collective. Because to make that as the breaking point, for many it's just a matter of, okay, so have you had the surgery? Oh, you have. Okay, so then you're legitimate. Oh, you haven't. Okay, well, do you plan to? It creates a kind of a gradient of legitimacy for many people. And it also kind of creates a line in the sand between the band members as far as who is and who isn't. I answer that usually best by saying I only discuss my biology with my doctor and my partners.
Mm-hmm. I was not really sure I wanted to ask that question.
Mm-hmm. No, I understand. And believe me, we've had people ask that in very, very different ways. Somebody that is not from the queer community, it usually involves quite a bit of finger-tapping on my behalf, because I recognize that we have to... Our very existence is political for many people, and getting the word out and explaining all of this is part of it. I mean, I used to laugh at Sean Penn when he would, you know, beat up a photographer and continually say to myself, why don't you just go get a job that doesn't involve publicity, you idiot? But eventually realizing people still ask that question, and as much as irritated, if you will, as I could get with that, it's part of my responsibility to make sure that people understand my position, my thought, and if I'm educating anybody, well, that's terrific.
You probably have received a lot of mail from people who look up to you as mentors.
Yes, mentors, inspirations, and so on. I had a birthday very recently, and I was actually quite down that morning. And that morning I woke up, and I received... I had never received birthday email, fan mail, in my life. And it came from as far away as New Zealand to Germany. And I was really surprised that I could have an impact like this. This is staggering. And yet, looking back on it, when I was growing up, if I would have known what the notion of transgenderism was about when I was growing up, it's hard to say what I would have done. But there were no positive role models. I mean, all of the role models were negative. I mean, this is a classic, a classic argument for any minority. So to think that there are people out there that look to us as a band being something positive and inspirational, reading about us in the paper and magazines and saying, wow, look, transgendered people in the news, and it's not because they're dead. That's makes me quite happy.
Is there an overall message you hope your band gets across?
I would hope the message is that, well, you know, we're trans, and we're quite proud of ourselves, and not proud of ourselves as much as proud of who we are. And even though I don't want to kind of beat that dead horse, I think the inspirational note should be that I just hope everybody walks away from this feeling like we're making a positive impact.
Well, I think they are. You can find out more about the band at www.lipstickconspiracy.com. I'm down to the last song, but before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening, and I especially want to thank David Cunard, Terry Noel, and Serafina Maricino of Lipstick Conspiracy for the wonderful interviews. And, as I had expected, the interviews were so good that I could not fit all of them into the radio version of this show, so my internet listeners could hear an extended version with a lot more comments and additional music. That, of course, can be found at www.queermusicheritage.com. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. You'll want to come back next month for another show on transgendered music. While researching for this show, I found so much material I wanted to share that I just needed to make it a two-parter. And now for one last question with Serafina. What song gets the most audience reaction?
Well, our first quote-unquote hit was Just a Girl, and that was the one that got everybody's attention, because in the early days, we would usually only do two or three songs whenever we would play, just because of the type of venues that we would play. Just a Girl also was the first song off of the first album, and everybody assumed it was, you know, the single or the hit. And I think it was also something that everybody kind of grasped onto because of the lyrics and the fact that it was a very, very fun party song. The song was actually written and sung by Marilyn, basically saying, you know, this is what it's like to be, you know, a tranny in a rock band, and this is who I am and what I am.
Lipstick Conspiracy and Just a Girl.
Some people ask me why I dress this way. A crazy drag queen or perhaps you're gay. Is there a point to all these fancy clothes? With all these buckles from your head down to your toes. Some sympathy. No, I'm trying to be the best girl I can be.
Done all.
KPFT has just completed its Spring 2007 Membership Drive. If you're one of the many listeners who joined this drive, thank you very much. You've made a contribution to your community that is appreciated. It will go a long way to bringing you the great radio you've come to enjoy. Before you know it, your membership envelope will arrive in the mail. Don't forget to pay your pledge. The great feeling you get when you support KPFT feels even better once you drop that check in the mail. And if you missed your chance to join and support the news, music, and other great programming you hear each day, there's still time. Join online at kpfd.org and do your part. Your pledge is tax deductible, and if your employer has a matching gifts program, your pledge could be doubled. That's kpft.org to pledge now. Thanks again. This is
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.